Today is Monday, February 20th. We're going to work more on blood pressure regulation and bulk fluid transport at the capillaries.
Okay, so for our first scenario, we have someone scared through an adrenaline rush, maybe seeing a snake in her home. So we know that the first issue here is going to be a stimulus that carries this information back to the vasomotor center and cardiac center in the brain. So does this sound more like a chemoreceptor issue or a baroreceptor issue? Okay, so if you're thinking chemo, what chemical change might cause those chemoreceptors to be affected? Maybe epinephrine. Okay, chemoreceptors only detect three things. That's oxygen, carbon dioxide, hydrogen ion concentration. So if we eliminate those three, then now we're only left with baroreceptors, yeah. So what do you think tipped off those baroreceptors? Blood pressure, yeah. So this must be a blood pressure issue. Perhaps she was so scared her blood pressure increased due to the adrenaline rush. So that adrenaline rush would be our stimulus, and the receptors that detected this change would be those baroreceptors. So those baroreceptors tattletale information by way of some cranial nerves to your brain. Specifically, what part of the brain are we going to? Vasomotor center and cardiac center. Okay, so these baroreceptors carry information about both heart rate and blood pressure. And where specifically in the brain is this center located? Medulla oblongata. Good. So the control center makes a decision on how we should handle the increase in blood pressure. So should we activate more parasympathetic control or more sympathetic control? Parasympathetic, right. If the blood pressure is too high, the control center should say, hey, turn on the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so we know there's parasympathetic innervation to your heart. That will tell your SA node to fire more slowly. So that lowers heart rate. Now here's the catch. Is there parasympathetic innervation to your blood vessels? There's not. So all we can do then is decrease, you got it, sympathetic stimulation. So we decrease sympathetic stimulation to your vessels, and in response to decreased epinephrine and norepinephrine, what happens to the diameter of your vessels? Dilates, good. So they relax, they dilate, and now blood pressure will go down. Yep, so decrease or go down. This is kind of like a 1-2 punch. It's a tag team approach. So by increasing parasympathetic stimulation to your heart and decreasing sympathetic stimulation to heart and vessels, we get not only your heart rate to drop, but also your blood pressure to drop as well. So that will counter the effects of something that's caused an increase in blood pressure. Does this one make sense? Any questions on this one? Okay. Let me give you a moment to either mentally answer these or jot down the answers. We've got a person who is running. His CO2 levels are increased. And then I'll let you work it out from there. Thank you. So let's take this one because we've got a carbon dioxide increase. That increase in CO2 is going to be our stimulus. That points us in the direction of a particular receptor. Which one? Chemoreceptor, right. Do you recall where the chemoreceptors are located? Aorta and
common carotids,
right. So there's chemoreceptors there. There's also chemoreceptors in your brain. They're going to tattletale to your vasomotor center and your cardiac center. And in response, those centers, those control centers, decide how to handle this problem. If you have excess CO2, what is the response?
Increased
sympathetic stimulation to both heart and vessels. And in response, your heart rate will increase. And what happens to your vessel diameter? Constrict. So we want to see this as a big picture issue. How does increasing heart rate and blood pressure help you if you've got too much CO2 in your bloodstream?
It's
going to
pump that blood faster and get that CO2 out.
Perfect. Great. Pump the blood faster, circulate it to the lungs, let the lungs get rid of it more quickly. So the more CO2 you've got, the faster you breathe, the higher your heart rate, the higher your blood pressure. So it's all linked together. If you worked this one out in your paper, did you get it right? Okay. Would you like one more to try? Okay. This one's a little different. Walk this one out one more time. Stimulus, effectors, the whole nine yards of those four feedback loop steps. So if you want to map this one out, your first step would be the stimulus. The next thing would be your receptor. Then your control center's job. And then finally the effector. And I think if you map this one out, it's going to give you the right answer. Okay, so let's walk it through. What is the stimulus with this problem? Low blood pressure. Okay, so if she's hemorrhaging means blood loss, and so that can directly affect her cardiac output. If her cardiac output is low, that also can reduce heart rate and that can reduce blood pressure. So initially, that's going to cause both heart rate and blood pressure to decline. Okay, so there's your stimulus. What type of receptor is going to tell the brain about the low blood pressure?
Baroreceptors,
good. Now in response, the control centers in the brain, the medulla, are going to have a response to this. They say we should do what? Increase heart rate, increase blood pressure, thank you. And we do that through what type of stimulation? Sympathetic, right. So we should increase sympathetic stimulation to the heart and increase sympathetic stimulation to your vessels. Now, of course, the effectors are SA node fires faster and heart rate increases. And what happens to your vessel diameter? It constricts, good. And that causes blood pressure to go up. Okay, so if you think about this as a negative feedback loop, it makes sense as to why somebody may initially have normal looking blood pressure and heart rate. What is happening here? Good. compensating for the loss. So it looks okay for now, not going to last forever, right? So it's compensating as long as it can. Eventually, we may not be able to keep up, but that's all it is. It's a compensation for the problem. Did you figure this one out before we made all the steps? I'll give you one more here to take a look at. Okay, let's walk this one through all four steps. The issue is we have too much vasopressin, which has caused an increase in blood pressure. That is your what?
Stimulus.
That's your stimulus, good. What type of receptor tattletales about our situation?
Yeah.
Good. Where's the control center located?
Medulla
oblongata, good. So what specifically will the vasomotor center do with this information?
Decrease the blood.
Good. Vasomotor center says decrease sympathetic stimulation. Cardiac center says decrease sympathetic, increase parasympathetic. Okay, so when we think about the control center, they're sending out, of course, the dictate, and the effector is, well, the SA node will fire what? More slowly. And what happens to your blood pressure?
Decreases,
good. So what must we do to your vessel diameter?
Dilate
it, right. So vessels dilate, heart rate falls. So we see a slowed heart rate and a decreased blood pressure. That's going to cause everything to slow down. So it's a decrease in sympathetic to the heart and to the vessels, and an increase in parasympathetic only to the heart. Do you keep in mind the role of the vagus nerve here? The vagus nerve is activated during this kind of problem. So the vagus nerve is an innervation to which part, heart or vessels? Just the heart, yeah. And it releases which neurotransmitter to the heart? ACH, yeah. So it slows the heart rate using acetylcholine. Did this one click for you? Do you have any questions on it? Could you answer one of these come test day?
Natalie.
Yeah, we just decrease it and we balance it by increasing parasympathetic to the heart.
So it would be wrong if we said that the sympathetic system balances at all.
I'd probably take it, but yeah, it's not totally off, it's just lessened. Yeah. If you'd like one more to practice through, here's one on ketoacidosis. So in this situation, we've got a diabetic who's experiencing ketoacidosis. Now our stimulus is what? Acidosis, yeah. That means the pH is where? is low. That means we have too many hydrogen ions. So that is our stimulus. What type of receptor picks up on this information?
Chemoreceptor,
good. Those chemoreceptors tell our brain of the situation. The cardiovascular center has two components, the cardiac center and the vascular or vasomotor center. So what does the cardiac center say we should do to heart rate?
Increase
it, yeah. So how do we get it faster?
Increase
sympathetic stimulation and at the same time decrease parasympathetic, right. So what neurotransmitter should we send the heart?
Epinephrine
and norepinephrine, yeah. So decrease ACH release to the heart. At the same time, the vasomotor center talks to those vessels, specifically innervating the tunica media. And so this time we're going to tell the vessel diameter to
constrict,
right. So what happens ultimately with blood pressure and heart rate? Both increase. Once again, let's think big picture here. If you increase heart rate and blood pressure, what else also goes up?
Breathing.
Good. So the faster you breathe, the faster your heart beats, the faster your or higher your blood pressure goes, the easier it is to get rid of acidosis because you blow off more CO2, and that's a story for another day. But that's actually what we're doing here is we're getting the excess hydrogen ions to blow out of our respiratory system. So that's kind of where this is taking us ultimately. Do you feel like if I gave you a problem and the four steps to map it out, you could answer this in the form of an essay question? I'm seeing some yeses and I'm seeing some, oh my gosh. Is there anywhere that I can help you or is it just more practice that you need?
I would get confused, like keto acidosis. I wouldn't have known what that does to either the blood pressure. So if you gave me one of those, I'll get it wrong.
The thing to look for is one of like four things. Look for it to say some kind of blood pressure problem. Look for it to say something having gone wrong with CO2, oxygen, acidosis, or alkalosis.
Okay, so acidosis, I'm taking it that lowers the blood pressure.
Well, it's not that it lowers your blood pressure. It actually has nothing to do with your pressure.
It's chemo.
It's chemo. It's right.
It lowers the pH.
There you go. If you've got alkalosis, let's say you've had somebody that had a bunch of Tums. A man had a really awful stomach ache, so Tums said, he says, oh, I can eat several of these, and they don't really help, so he eats several more. And if you're in alkalosis, the way to get your blood pH back in normal range is to actually lower heart rate and lower blood pressure. So it's this kind of number. It's opposite effect. You actually bring up a really important point. I do want to point out, if you're talking about acid, base, carbon dioxide, or oxygen, your blood pressure may be just fine. It may be completely normal. So it's the chemical changes in your bloodstream that are causing the problems. And the way you fix the chemical change is by altering heart rate and blood pressure. And so the whole underlying issue may have nothing to do with your heart rate or blood pressure, but that's how we're going to compensate for the problem. So I just want to make sure that we see that point there. Any questions on this stuff? Any points that I can clarify?
Do you see this being more of an essay question than anything?
Both. I can guarantee you it'll be an essay, and I can also tell you it'll be a number of multiple choice. I'll pinpoint, I'll say I've got a chemical problem, what kind of receptor picks up on it. I may say to you, I've got a blood pressure problem, what do I do to fix it? So I'll give you pieces of this whole mechanism and ask you guys to figure out what we're targeting there. By the way, if you would like to have this PowerPoint, it's got questions and answers built in. This is all on D2L. This is blood vessels number 2. So if you'd like to download the PowerPoint, everything is just kind of built in here. Okay. Why don't we turn the page and go on to 56. page 56, you've got some chemicals that also influence blood pressure. So the catch is, there is only sympathetic innervation to your vessels, and there is no parasympathetic innervation. So that means either you ramp up and increase epinephrine and norepinephrine, which makes your vessels constrict and pressure to go up, or you decrease epinephrine and norepinephrine, and in that case, what happens to blood pressure? It goes down. So there is no direct innervation for the parasympathetic nervous system to your blood vessels. What that tells me is, I don't have a really good way for us to say, hey, blood vessels, I want you to relax. You simply have to wait for the decrease of epinephrine and norepinephrine to take effect. Now, these are three chemicals that can also influence blood vessels and their diameter. The first one is one that we make. It's called histamine. Thinking back to blood cells, what specific white blood cell makes histamine?
Basophils.
Basophils, good. You may recall they are the least common white blood cell, which is really significant when you think about all those basophils dumping their histamine into the bloodstream. Well, this is what histamine does. It can cause a case of itchy rash and hives. It makes your blood vessels leak, and it's meant to be a response to an allergic reaction. So if you've had, say, a mosquito bite, or maybe a bee sting, or maybe you've touched something that you're allergic to, perhaps you have a shrimp allergy, those kinds of allergies may cause those basophils to all of a sudden just dump their histamine, vessels relax and dilate, and where does blood pressure go? Blood pressure goes down. The unfortunate side effect of a histamine reaction is it can produce a form of shock. What kind of shock? Anaphylactic, right. So anaphylactic shock can result from a histamine reaction. We know we can give antihistamines to prevent further basophil release of histamines. Well, that's certainly a helpful thing, but what if you need help right this minute? What can cause your vessels to constrict and your blood pressure to increase? Epinephrine, right. So if you have severe allergies, you carry an EpiPen, right? Okay, so an EpiPen, of course, causes vasoconstriction, blood pressure goes up, and it combats the leakiness of vessels that we see with a histamine reaction. Okay, the other kinds of chemicals here, nitrous oxide, is also made by your body. It is released by your blood vessels. It, too, is a vasodilator. What impact does nitrous have on your blood pressure? Decreases, right. So what happens to your vessel diameter? It relaxes, dilates, right. So if you've ever been to the dentist office and been administered laughing gas is nitrous oxide. And when they put this laughing gas across your nose, it's supposedly is to relax you and to keep you from being fully aware of the events that are happening. So if they do this, they also place on your finger a pulse meter that also measures oxygen content in your bloodstream. So if they put it on there and they have not yet administered the laughing gas and your heart rate is, say, 75 beats per minute, are they looking for an increase or a decrease in your heart rate to be a problem?
Decrease.
Why do you think laughing gas would make your heart rate decrease? It makes your vessels relax. And if your blood pressure goes down, guess who goes down as well? Heart rate goes down too. So they go hand in hand. So that may initially occur until we see a compensation mechanism kick in. But if we have a blood pressure and heart rate that are too low, what could happen to your cells and tissues? They could die. Yes, so we want to make sure that that oximeter that's measuring oxygen in your finger stays close to 98% or so. That means we're getting enough oxygen to your peripheral tissues. You may have heard of huffing before. All these aerosol canisters contain nitrous oxide under pressure, and if you inhale the contents off of that can, you can inhale nitrous oxide. Well, if you inhale nitrous oxide, it makes your blood pressure drop, and then after you return back to sanity, I guess, your heart rate and blood pressure increase due to a flood of oxygen back into your system. So it's called huffing. It's a way to essentially get high because you're depriving your brain of oxygen. The flood of oxygen gives you a sense of euphoria after this canister is puffed or breathed in. So what is the danger of having something like this? decrease oxygen to your brain, yeah. So we don't know how much is being decreased. We just know that some level is being decreased, and that's the problem. It's an unregulated amount of nitrous to your brain. That's some scary stuff. The last one is nicotine, and nicotine is a vasoconstrictor. That is not something your body makes, but something that comes in tobacco products. So we know that nicotine is a potent vasoconstrictor. It will increase your blood pressure and in turn your heart rate. So simply by itself, nicotine does increase both heart rate and blood pressure. They say that e-cigarettes also have nicotine in them, and they too can increase heart rate and blood pressure because of the effects of nicotine. So they're advertising that those are not at face value as safe as they may seem. It's, you know, certainly not inhaling smoke, but it's still a nicotine-based product that you're getting. So for those who have a heart condition, this e-cigarette or vaping may not actually be the best choice to get your nicotine fix. Okay. The bottom of the page is largely a review for us. We've been here already. I just want to kind of tie in some of these hormones that we've talked about before. We've seen epinephrine and norepinephrine. They do both increase cardiac output. How is that? Good. They increase blood pressure and they increase heart rate. That, of course, increases cardiac output. And on average, what is the typical cardiac output? 5 liters, yeah, about 5 liters of blood circulated at a given time. So we know epi and ne can do the increase for cardiac output through the increase of heart rate and blood pressure. What role do beta blockers play with epinephrine and norepinephrine? Fights against them, decreases, right. So decreases heart rate, decreases blood pressure. Let's talk about ADH. We know that ADH is also a vasoconstrictor. What impact will it have on cardiac output? Increase, good. So ADH retains water. That is another thing to influence cardiac output. We know that cardiac output is the number one determinant for blood pressure. So the more water you're transporting, the higher the blood pressure can go. I did want to address the question that I've put there in the worksheet for you. Why do you think a patient might receive vasopressin rather than epinephrine as a way to increase blood pressure? What does epinephrine do to your heart rate?
Increases heart rate.
Increases heart rate, yes. So it directly increases heart rate. ADH, however, is a vasoconstrictor. It has no direct role on your heart. So it only increases blood pressure without directly increasing heart rate. That's why it may be chosen as a medication for a patient who has blood pressure issues, hypotension or low blood pressure. So to answer that question, ADH increases cardiac output and blood pressure. ADH increases cardiac output and blood pressure. Without directly influencing the heart rate. So ADH increases cardiac output and blood pressure without directly influencing heart rate. We've talked a little bit about the renin-angiotensin mechanism. We know that angiotensin also is a vasoconstrictor. It too will increase blood pressure. And I also want to introduce another drug called an ACE inhibitor. You'll notice that the ACE inhibitor's job is to block the release of angiotensin and down the road, aldosterone as well. So if you're under the effects of an ACE inhibitor, what impact will that have on blood pressure? Decrease it, yeah. ACE inhibitors decrease blood pressure. So specifically, the inhibitor blocks angiotensin II and aldosterone, and that's how we decrease the blood pressure. So we've got three that increase pressure here. We've only got one to decrease pressure. There's a star beside this one just to remind us, AMP is the only hormone that decreases blood pressure. It antagonizes aldosterone. And so if it antagonizes aldosterone, it makes you lose more water, salt, and fat loads into your urine. And by decreasing the amount of fluid you have, you decrease your cardiac output. If you decrease cardiac output, what happens to blood pressure? It goes down as well. So that's actually how AMP works. It works against aldosterone, so it dumps out urine, which is heavy in salt, water, and fat. Any questions on page 56? If you would like to use page 57 as practice, the answers are on D2L. Look at the news at the very bottom. There are several files linked, including the answers to page 57. All right, switching gears completely. Topic called bulk fluid exchange at the capillaries. We know that capillaries are the thinnest walled vessels we've got, and for that reason, they are the site of fluid exchange with surrounding cells and tissues. So this concept is called bulk flow or bulk exchange of fluids. So I'm going to start you out on page 58. We're going to work through page 58 and 59, and this is going to be the last big topic for this chapter. So when we think about capillaries, there's several routes for items to travel across the walls. We've got diffusion that can move small or lipid-based items across the walls of the capillaries, and we can also actively transport proteins. But that's not really our focus right now. What we want to focus on is how do fluids wash out into the interstitial space, and why do they wash out into that space, and how do we reclaim the fluid back into the capillary? So it has to do with the spaces between these cells that form the capillary. There's enough room here for water to be forced out of the capillary into surrounding cells and tissues. The whole reason behind this is due to your cardiovascular system. So we know the highest pressure is felt in which vessels? Aorta, arteries, okay? Where does the biggest decline in pressure come? Arterioles. Yeah, notice that huge drop off in pressure in the arterioles. And our focus today is the capillary, which has pressure in the mid-30s all the way down to the mid-teens. Notice these veins and venules have practically no pressure. They're not really involved in regulating blood pressure because they have no pressure to begin with. So our goal here is to understand how fluids get pushed out of capillaries where the high pressure end is located, and how do we absorb it back in at the low-pressure venule end of that capillary. So I'd like to introduce to you two battling pressures. These pressures are osmotic and hydrostatic in nature. Okay, so the one that you're already familiar with is called hydrostatic pressure. It's alternately called blood pressure. So I'm going to keep a running tab of these pressures over here on the side. Pressure and hydrostatic pressure are the very same thing. We know that hydro means water, and this particular pressure is based on the water in your bloodstream. The force of the water pushing against the walls of your vessels is what creates blood pressure, otherwise known as hydrostatic pressure. We're going to focus strictly on the type of hydrostatic pressure inside your bloodstream because that's created by the heart's pumping activity. So I do want to tell you that I'm going to call this one BHP for short, which stands for blood hydrostatic pressure. Okay? And this particular pressure is a force created by the push of water against the walls of your capillaries. All right, so hydrostatic pressure, or BHP for short, is a pressure that pushes fluids. Okay, that's something we want to keep in mind. This is a pressure that pushes fluids. So just for a second, let's go back to that previous picture. We're talking about the bulk fluid transport of fluids of capillaries. So notice here, when we enter a capillary, the pressure's in the mid-30s. And when we leave the capillary, the pressure is as low as the mid-teens. So the highest hydrostatic pressure is going to be on the arterial end of your capillary. That's where you've got pressure in the mid-30s. The second battling pressure is going to be osmotic pressure. All right, so this is taking you way back to Bio-210. When you studied osmosis in Bio-210, we know that water always follows what?
Salt.
Okay. So osmotic pressure is actually salt pressure. But I've got to add something to this. It's salt pressure and protein pressure. So this particular pressure we're going to call BOP because, again, our focus here is on blood. So B in BOP stands for blood osmotic pressure. So you can kind of get the sense here that we've got the force that pushes fluids called blood pressure or hydrostatic pressure. You've got a battling force that pulls fluids. That's called osmotic pressure. That's created by the salts and proteins in your bloodstream. So you have the battle set up. You've got a push-pull pressure battle. Okay? To do is also review with you the two main locations of fluids because that's what we're going to influence here. Way back in Bio-210, you guys probably talked about fluid compartments. The number one storage space for fluids is where? Intracellular, good, and that is where?
Inside
your cells, right. About two-thirds or 66% of your fluids are stored inside your cells. The other one-third is stored inside your spaces, such as between cells and tissues, blood plasma, things of that sort. So that's what we're going to watch here is how we influence those fluid compartments. What I'd like to do is replicate the picture on the bottom of your page. We're going to add some pressures onto that picture so we can understand this push-pull battle of the two pressures. I'm going to start you with the arterial end of the capillary. So we've got a capillary that we're looking at. We're specifically following how capillaries exchange fluids because they are thin-walled. No other vessel has such thin walls made only of tunica intima. Outside outside your capillary, you've got a space called the interstitial space, and IF, or interstitial fluid, is housed in that space. Just to review, interstitial fluid is not inside cells. So, is it extracellular or intracellular? It's extracellular. Okay, inside cells, of course, is ICF. That's where the majority of our fluids are housed. So we're just going to kind of keep these fluid compartments straight. And just to remind us, the plasma that's flowing through our blood is, in fact, extracellular fluid, or ECF. Okay, does everything make sense so far? Your two pressures? Okay, ICF versus ECF makes sense.
What did you say ECF stood for?
That's extracellular fluid. Arterial end, blood pressure coming through is high. In a capillary, that means it's about 35 millimeters mercury of pressure. Don't worry about memorizing the number. Instead, I'd rather you focus on how this battle plays out. So here at the arterial end, blood hydrostatic pressure is about 35 millimeters mercury. Blood osmotic pressure is created by the salts and proteins circulating in our bloodstream. We know that water follows salt, and that means that the attraction power of this blood is around 26 millimeters mercury. What you need to know is that the higher number wins the battle, and since we're pushing with a pressure of 35 millimeters mercury, and we're only pulling with 26, who wins the battle?
Push.
Push. So hydrostatic pressure is the pushing pressure, and that pushes fluids out into our interstitial space. So this pushing pressure is called filtration. Back when you studied membrane transport in Bio-210, you probably talked about diffusion and osmosis and all those types of things. We don't cover filtration, that can cover membrane transport, but it is in fact a way for us to transport fluids across a capillary. What we just accomplished is called filtration. And what this means is fluids are forced out of your capillary and into the interstitial space. So capillaries are leaky. There are spaces between most capillary walls. They're called fenestrations. That allows for the fluids to be pushed with ease out into the interstitial space. You know, if you've ever seen one of those garden hoses that is like basically a tire that's had holes punched in it, that's what a capillary is. It just allows for fluids to leak into the interstitial space. This is not meant to be a closed capillary, but rather one that allows for the exchange with the interstitial environment. So much fluid leaks and leaks and leaks that by the time you reach the venule end of your capillary, look what happened to blood pressure. BHP is now down to 15 to 17. like I said, don't memorize the numbers, but rather appreciate what's about to happen. Because osmotic pressure tends to stay fairly stable at 26 across the length of your capillary, now at your venule end, which pressure is the winner? BOP is your winner. So what happens to the fluids in your interstitial space? Pull them back in, exactly. So we now finally start returning fluids back in, and this is called reabsorption. So filtration is at the arterial end of your capillary. Reabsorption occurs at the venule end of your capillary. Pressure is responsible for filtration at your arterial end? BHP, which is blood pressure or hydrostatic. But which pressure is responsible for reabsorption at your venule end? Blood osmotic pressure, right. And that one's based upon salts and proteins in the bloodstream. I should mention to you, because this is where we're heading on Wednesday, that 90% of what is forced out gets reclaimed back in at the venule end of your capillary. So that's not 100% is pushed out and is pulled back in. That means 10% of the fluids that you are filtering stay out here in the interstitial space and hang out. Now that can be a problem because you can have something called edema when excess fluids accumulate in the interstitial space. But good news for us, there is another vessel that travels nearby, very porous vessel, and it picks up these escaped fluids. What is the name of that vessel? Lymphatic, right. So as long as you have a functional working lymphatic system, that will pick up those escaped fluids that did not get reabsorbed back at the venule end of your capillary. There are 11 questions over on page 59. I'm going to cut you loose for a few minutes and let you answer those, and then we'll get back together and do the answers, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to think about this stuff first. Okay, let's hit answers for that page, starting with number one. Number one asks, what happens to blood hydrostatic pressure from one end of your capillary to the other? It decreases. And the reason behind that is actually two reasons. Not only are we getting a lot of the fluid pushed out of along the length of the capillary, that's one thing that contributes to the loss of pressure. We're also getting further from the heart. And the force of that push from the contraction of the heart is going to lessen the further we get away. It's that whole concept of peripheral resistance and vessel length. But the main answer there for number one is hydrostatic pressure decreases along the length of your capillary. Number two, the drop in BHP allows fluids to travel where? Back in. Good. So number two, the drop in BHP allows fluids to enter the capillary. Number three, plasma proteins are like salt. They pull water back into the capillary. So keep in mind the word plasma gives us a clue that we're talking about proteins in the bloodstream. They're going to pull fluids back into the capillary. For number four, why does fluid return to the capillary at the venous end, but not at the arterial end?
Water inside.
So BOP pulls the fluids back in, But we have to have a decrease in what?
BHP.
Yeah, BHP has to decrease in order for BOP to do its pulling job. Okay? So for number four, finally, BHP decreases and BOP can pull the fluid back in. BHP decreases and BOP can pull the fluid back in. For number five, does osmotic pressure vary from the arterial to the venous end of the capillary?
No.
It's stable, right? Okay, so it does not vary. That's always, yeah, the osmotic pressure. How about hydrostatic pressure? What happens to it?
Yes, it's from
high. It drops from high pressure to low pressure. Okay, so hydrostatic pressure does vary from the arterial to the venous end. It drops from high pressure at your arterial end to low pressure at your venous end. Okay, so it drops from high pressure at your arterial end to low pressure at your venous end. Okay, number six, what happens to any fluids that are not returned to circulation? Good, picked up by the lymphatic vessel. Okay, picked up by the lymphatic vessel. So number seven and number eight, I didn't really talk to you about any pressure in the interstitial space, so I'll go ahead and mention to you that there is a very small interstitial fluid pressure, both hydrostatic and osmotic. So if we were to say that hydrostatic pressure out in the interstitial space is less than one, that should help us address number seven. So how does hydrostatic pressure differ from the capillary to the interstitial space? Yeah, interstitial is definitely lower. Capillary has a much higher hydrostatic pressure. And you can point that back at the heart creating that high hydrostatic pressure in the capillary. There is no pump to create pressure in the interstitial space. I would say that there is higher hydrostatic pressure in the capillary due to the heart. Higher hydrostatic pressure in the capillary due to the heart.
So do we even need to mention that it's lower in the interstitial fluid?
Not really, and you don't really need to know that it's less than a millimeter out there. It's just a very negligible pressure. Same thing with number eight. There is very little osmotic pressure in your interstitial space. It's around 1 millimeter mercury or less. So what does that tell you about the amount of solutes and proteins in your interstitial space? There aren't many, yeah. Most of your salts and proteins are in your capillary. So with a BOP of 26 in your capillary and an osmotic pressure of about one or less in your interstitial space, the greater pressure is in your capillary due to a greater presence of salts and proteins. Okay, so a greater BOP in your capillary due to a greater presence of salts and proteins. So what pressure is responsible for filtration? Number 9.
BHP.
Good. BHP is the pushing pressure. Number 10, which pressure is responsible for reabsorption? BOP, the pulling pressure. And number 11, if you can't pick up those proteins by the lymphatic system, which pressure is primarily affected? Osmotic, good, that's BOP. Natalie. For the protein portion or the interstitial portion? For number 11, the first part there, if you've got protein, and proteins do get pushed out into the interstitial space, but the real catch is they create their own pool of osmotic pressure, and if you can't pick them up by the lymphatic system, they actually pull fluids out into the interstitial space, and they don't let it get pulled back into either the capillary or the lymphatic system. That's way longer than you've heard that little tiny line. But basically, it's they create their own pressure out there. And the second part of number 11 is really the same explanation. If you get interstitial fluids trapped in your interstitial space, and you can't get those fluids back into the capillary, and you can't get them back into the lymphatic system, which pressure is now affected inside your capillary? BHP, hydrostatic. And unfortunately, that causes edema when those fluids accumulate in that interstitial space. Why don't we save page 60? We'll talk about that as a lead-in for our conversation on Wednesday. And that'll wrap up this chapter. We'll start lymphatic Wednesday, may do a little respiratory as well. All right, I'll see y'all on Wednesday.